Tehran urging the U.S. president to stop meddling in its affairs. This in reaction to Biden's comments on the recent riots in Iran. Ukrainian missiles land on a new target in Donetsk. Plus, Chinese president doubling down on peaceful reunification with Taiwan. He hints at Beijing having to use force if necessary. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjafik. Good to have you with us. The Iranian foreign ministry is reacting to comments by the U.S. president over the wave of riots in the country, calling them meddlesome. The ministry's spokesman says that Joe Biden is backing rioters in the tradition of U.S. officials, a move that he described as fishing in troubled waters. Nasser Kanani says that Biden is frustrated by years of futile action against Iran, adding that his interventions and expressions of surprise won't weaken the country's resolve. Biden has called the Iranian government oppressive, expressing surprise at, using his own words, the courage of people and women taken to the streets. Kanani also stressed that Iran is strong enough not to give in to brutal sanctions and hollow threats. He said Iranians will stand up for their independence and join together to heal wounds, inflicting another defeat on Washington. An investigator reports by the Iranian parliament has concluded that the death of a 22-year-old woman was not due to assault and battery. According to the report, Mahsa Amini was not assaulted during her transfer to a police station or while being held there. The findings, however, questioned the effectiveness of the first medical response that she received. The report says a crowd amassing outside a police station could have delayed her transfer to the hospital. Parliament report has called on those who jumped to conclusions about the cause of Amini's death to correct their position or face prosecution. It says that the U.S., Israel, and their followers took advantage of such hasty judgments to stir up unrest. Days ago, the Iranian coroner's office also announced that her death was not due to blows to her head or any of her vital organs, but due to cerebral hypoxia and multiple organ failure. Amini died in a hospital after 3 days. Her death triggered a wave of riots in the country. Iranian officials say the situation is under control at Tehran's Evin prison, where a fire broke out early in the day. According to the authorities, firefighters put out a blaze, which broke out in one of the prison wards. It followed a brawl among a number of prisoners convicted of financial crimes and theft. Gunshots and explosions were also heard. At least 8 people have been injured during the incident, which caused no mortalities. Evin prison is located in the northern part of the Iranian capital city. The Ukrainian military has launched attacks on an administrative building in the eastern city of Donetsk. A correspondent, Jana Miller, says the strikes on the city's central administrative area are unprecedented, as it was previously outside the range of Ukrainian weapons. But now they're using Western-supplied weaponry to hit new Russian-held positions.
The central city administration building was hit this morning, just a few hours ago, by Ukraine. It was hit by American HIMARS missiles. Interestingly, the last week or so, I have seen a lot more people on the streets in Donetsk, a lot more cars on the roads, as people are slowly returning to the city. Why? Because there's a feeling that the Russian or pro-Russian forces have made some advances on the outskirts of Donetsk, stopping conventional Ukrainian artillery from shelling the center. The outskirts are still shelled every day, but it's more difficult for Ukraine to shell the center. So it's only the American HIMARS and the French Caesar artillery pieces that are able to hit the center now. And this strike this morning, there's been many strikes around the city, but this strike is very important. Why? Because Ukraine is, when it's not hitting military targets, often focuses on civilian targets. When I go to the where these strikes hit, it's often a bus station or a market with bodies lying in the street. But so far, they've largely held off hitting administration centers in Donetsk. Why? Perhaps one of the reasons is because they don't want to provoke the Russians from hitting decision-making centers in Kiev. But of course, a week or so ago, we had the attack on Kerch, the Kerch-Crimean bridge, and then Russia has stepped up and widened its parameters of strikes within Ukraine, hitting power stations and some decision-making centers as well. So this may well be, in turn, another retaliatory strike from Ukraine. So this conflict now here is escalating, both by Russia and by Ukraine.
As the energy crisis continues to bite in Italy, people from all walks of life have been staging protests across the nation. From students to workers, Italians are urging the next government to put the community back in the center of political discourse and work for peace. Our correspondent Max Civile reports.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
The Chinese president says that his government is committed to peaceful reunification with Taiwan, but might have to use force if necessary. Xi Jinping rejected any form of separatism and interference over the several islands that China considers part of its territory. Beijing has strongly opposed Washington's military ties with Taipei, calling the U.S. military presence in the region provocative. Xi also pointed out that Beijing is against the Cold War mentality in international politics and interference in other countries' internal issues. He also praised the current stable conditions in Hong Kong, which he said has made a transition from chaos to governance. He insisted that Hong Kong be ruled by patriots, reaffirming 2020 legislation that bans non-patriots from positions of political power in the city. She was addressing the five-yearly Congress of the ruling Communist Party. Political analyst at Pangol Institution, Kendo Xu, says the Chinese president has made it clear that a Taiwan question is an internal issue of China and no business of any foreign country.
He made it very clear that the Taiwan question is about the reunification of China. It's an internal matter of the Chinese people. It's none of the business of any foreign power, including the United States. And also he said that, the use of force, basically the Chinese side wants to make sure all the options are on the table. If it's forced, if it is provoked, and it has to use force, it will be targeted at the foreign elements which supported the Taiwan independence, which supports the Taiwan separatist activities, and also those separatists in Taiwan, only a few of them, not the people in Taiwan, the absolute majority of people in Taiwan, who wants to keep a neutral status of Taiwan. They don't want to see any military conflicts across the strait. They don't want to see the Taiwan government, which is the pro-independent, which is pro-the U.S. right now. Their activities and their policies could actually create some trouble and even some dangers.
The Palestinian youth has succumbed to injuries he sustained in an attack by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Salfit. 31-year-old Mujahid Ahmed Mohammed Daoud died after he was critically shot in the chest earlier on Saturday. He was rushed to the hospital in Ramallah, where he was proclaimed dead. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories during past month. The Israeli military pressing on with its crackdown against Palestinians following a series of deadly attacks on the regime's forces. Resistance groups say that the attacks are in response to Israel's atrocities. Around 170 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since the start of this year, 15 in October alone. A big protest rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip following a Friday prayer to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The demonstration comes amid an increase in Israeli violations against Palestinians in the occupied Holy City. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has the details.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks.
We came today to show our unwavering support for the armed resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Zionists are desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and they only understand the language of force.
Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are desecrating Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The recent comments by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas about his mistrust of the U.S. and his contentment with Russia's position toward Palestine put into perspective why he and Palestinians as a whole do not trust the United States to have their interests in mind in any sort of negotiations. And that's why they reject any U.S. role in future peace talks between Israel and Palestine.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David agreements in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests, which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' rights to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tell about yourself.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of
journalism. Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, October 16th, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. And in the beginning, I do apologize for my rough voice.
Thank you.
And here I truly appreciate those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Paulo Duarte from the Philippines, and Helmut Metz from Germany. So, Mizanur Rahman, Paulo, and Helmut, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and, of course, your program, Listeners Special. As usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. So, all of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL card. And of course, we've received many emails and letters from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these great emails. Here we've received an email from Bala Murali from India. Again, from India, we've received an email from Shivandapol, one of our old and regular listeners. From Brazil, we've received an email from Antonio Santos. From Canada, we have an email from Alan Willey, one of our old and regular listeners. And last but not the least is an email from Jacques Augustin from France. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special. And as I said, here we received an email from France from Jacques Augustin, one of our old and regular listeners. Let's see what Jacques says. Dear friends, to begin this letter, I wish to thank you for the nice EQSL card and your kind message received last week. I'm glad to tell you I could listen to your radio despite a poor signal from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. I am pleased to submit my reception report to your consideration. I hope this report will be helpful to you. And if checked and found to be correct, can you send me the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran EQSL card as verification? In the broadcast heard, I paid much attention to the news and I wish America to lift economical sanctions against Iran. I conclude this letter wishing it has pleased you. And I would be glad to tune in again to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran and looking forward to hearing from you. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. And thank you very much for sending this email to us, Jacques Augustin from France. You mentioned a poor signal from IRIB English Radio, but be sure that we will fix the problem. So please accept our electronic QSL card as verification, Jacques Augustin. We're looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Wish you all the best. And from Brazil, we've received an email from Antonio Santos. Antonio Santos says, hello, friends. Greetings from Brazil. My name is Antonio Santos and I live in Sao Paulo. I'm sending you a reception report and I would like to get a paper QSL card by post from your radio. Special thanks. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Antonio Santos from Brazil. As you may know, sending any material, including paper QSL card on behalf of IRIB English Radio, is not possible in the time of pandemic. So for the time being, before this virus is eradicated all over the world, please accept our electronic QSL card. Wish you all the best. Welcome back. Bala Murali from India has sent us a message, a piece of email saying, "Dear staff, I'm writing to you after a long time. I hope you would be fine. I like your programs very much and your website too. And I especially like your news, photo galleries and videos. And I want your QSL card if possible. Thank you." Salam and warm greetings to you, Bala Murali from India, and please accept our warm gratitudes and appreciations to you for writing this email, and thank you for your compliments. It shows your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and listeners special. As for your request about sending you a paper QSL card, as you may know, it's not possible. I mean, sending any material, including paper QSL card on behalf of IRIB English Radio to our great listeners around the world is not possible in the time of pandemic. So for the time being, please accept our eQSL card and or, you know, electronic QSL card as verification. We wish you all the best. Bala Murali from India. Thank you. And from Canada, we've received an email from Alan Vili. Alan Vili from Canada says, "Dear staff, once again, hello from Newfoundland, Canada. Here is another set of reception reports attached of IRIB shortwave broadcast as monitored here in Newfoundland during the past few weeks. I hope it would be of your help. With best regards from Canada." First of all, salam and greetings to you, Alan Willie from Canada, and please accept our appreciations to you for this email, for this great message. We wish you all the best. Please write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. Alan Willie from Canada. Welcome back, and here we have another email from India from Shivanda Paul, one of our old and regular listeners. Let's see what Shivanda says. "Dear friends, greetings from India. I am Shivanda Paul, and I am from India. I am a regular listener of IRIB English Radio. Now, your reception is moderate. Signal strength is good, but slight noise and overall reception is moderate. My hobby is radio, listening to the radio and collecting stamps, coin, QSL cards, program schedule, etc. Please send QSL card and other souvenir items of Iran. Thank you." Salam and warm greetings to you, Shivanda Paul from India, one of our old and regular listeners. Thank you for letting us know your views about the quality of our programs. As you said, the signal strength is good, but a slight noise and overall reception is moderate. Thank you for reflecting on that. And as your request for sending you paper QSL cards and souvenir items of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting, unfortunately, sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio is not possible in the time of pandemic. So for the time being, please accept our electronic QSL card. Thank you. Now, dear listeners, here we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special. Please keep in touch with us and have a good time.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK government is in chaos. The Chancellor of the Exchequer was just sacked by the UK Prime Minister, Liz Truss, replaced by Jeremy Hunt, the former Foreign Secretary, who somehow is now fit to be the Finance Minister. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at how and what went so wrong for Prime Minister Liz Truss and her so-called mini-budget, with calls ringing louder for her resignation, and whether there's a lifeline for the UK economy or not. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian and journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from London. Also joining us is President of the European Institute for International Law, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosselin, I'll first start with you. Basically, let's find out from you what is your explanation behind what is going on, especially when it comes to this mini-budget, which is now turned out to be a real crisis for Liz Truss and her premiership.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of sabotage going on within the British economy. We had a whole month during September where there was a leadership contest between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, and the promise that Truss gave to all of those Conservative Party members was, "I will reduce your taxes." Well, of course, they just were thinking with their wallets and voted for her. The trouble is that actually there is nowhere that she could reduce taxes at all, really, because the markets have reacted in the way that the only way they could, which is to say, well, if you're going to reduce taxes, that means that the government borrowing, it cannot be paid back, and therefore we're going to have to, really, I suppose, punish you and tell you that we want the government to be able to pay its debts. And that's what they've done. The markets have punished them. They've said, if you're going to be cutting taxes, you're not going to be able to fulfil your budgetary needs in paying all these debts back. The fact is, the only place where at the moment where Truss and the government can actually get enough tax in is from the super rich. And these are the one group of people and the most powerful businesses. The businesses are very good at not paying tax, by the way. But the super rich, as they get paid income in Britain, they have, it's very easy to take that tax off them. And she was going to cut that. So, I mean, it was a disastrous policy from the start, just built on greed from the Conservative Party members voting for her. But as I said, I think there's an element of sabotage here. There are some powerful influences out there that do want to see economies crash. We've seen it in many other countries around the world. Okay. Argentina, I mean, the list goes on. And what happens is, as those economies start to crash, because most people think, well, you don't want that to happen, but some people do want that to happen, is they are then able to buy up all those assets for very little money and make an absolute fortune. We're talking about the people like George Soros, international dealers and traders that can make a fortune on a crash. This is the trouble, is the international markets, particularly those centred in the EU and in London, in the city, and in Wall Street, are basically like a casino. And so games are played, and that's what's been happening. And Liz Truss has completely lost touch with reality. This Chancellor, what they were doing is they were trying to do things which just had no economic sense to them whatsoever. And so I think now Kwarteng has gone, Liz Truss is going to have to go very soon because she backed him all the way. And the Conservative Party is going to have to find a new leader.
Well, we're going to get to those topics, especially the one that you say that there's maybe sabotage going on. But Mahmoud Rafat, if you can tell us in layman terms, what was so wrong with this mini budget that caused such a crisis, which has put into question the credibility of Liz Truss and her administration as a whole?
Well, which is appearing for us is the taxes problem and the bad plan which was put by the government of Truss, and especially to apply the same taxes on rich and poor, which represents a big contradiction with the social justice and also with the logic. But let's say, or let me repeat, this is what is appearing. Prime Minister Truss carried the heritage of long history of bad politics and also big messy. Don't forget, the Brexit is one of elements we can say not endamaged, but somehow broke big part of the British economy. Let's say also the markets in UK are not stable at all because of the big potentiality of the independence of Scotland next year, which will be followed for sure by independence of North Ireland. There is lots of elements she carried them as a heritage, or this government carried them, but she did not work on solving one of these dark elements. On the contrary, her government put a catastrophic plan, especially economic plan. Also, the involvement in UK strongly in the Russian-Ukrainian war was supporting one side, not only economically or militarily, but strategically. That's putting the UK economy in the same package or the same bucket of the war. And when there are wars, We always see investors do not trust so much in such economy. There is big trust used to be in the French economy, which we no longer find today, because of lots of elements she did not create, but she aggravated the situation by the tax cutting.
Well, let's get into what the Institute of Fiscal Studies has said here, Tony Gosling, because basically they pretty much hit the target when they talked about this mini budget. They called into question in terms of where the money was going to come from. And that was about, what, 60 billion pounds that the UK will need in spending cuts. It said that that unfunded tax cuts need to create that money. But how will the UK kind of be able to do that? Of course, we know in the books they have forecasted a certain percentage of growth. I think it was 2.5%. But they said at best 0.7 or 0.8% is how much the UK economy is going to grow. So that's a blatant piece of fact that's out there. How did Liz Truss and her former exchequer plan to convince people of that, which at this point is a void now?
I don't think they thought it through at all. I think that they had basically taken a few lines from an advertising agency in order to get themselves into power, get themselves elected in the election campaign over the summer, but they hadn't actually thought about what the implications might be. Look, let me just spell out a couple of basics here, because there is this thing called quantitative easing or printing money that the Bank of England's been doing. It's been using that money that it's created to purchase government bonds this week. It's just decided yesterday it's going to stop doing that, apparently, which means on Monday when the market's open, God only knows what's going to happen. We could have all sorts of problems with pensions. House prices could tank, mortgage rates going up. You know, this is becoming much more expensive for ordinary people. What should really happen with the money the Bank of England are making it up is they should just gift it to people who are on benefits, people who are on low pay, people that can't afford to buy food or having to go to food banks. Give it to them. Give each one of those people who are having to claim government subsidies or Social Security or whatever £2,000, because you know what? They'll spend the money and that will help all other elements of the economy. Because the way that they're spending this money at the moment is just going into the pockets of the people who have shares, and it's going in for asset purchases, and it's going to the rich, basically. So give that money, Bank of England, to the poor, and you'll see the economy start to pick up. So that's a really basic thing to understand. I mean, what we've had is, you're right, lots of instability. July, the Chancellor was Rishi Sunak. August, the Chancellor was Nadeem Zahawi. September, the Chancellor was Kwasi Kwarteng, and now in October we've got another Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. It gives the impression the Conservative Party haven't got a clue what they're doing.
Exactly.
And it's very unlikely that they will come up with policies now which will help the poorer people, which is it's the poor are the only ones who will actually manage to pick the economy up, I think, and get it moving again.
Well, you touched on a very important point there, and Mahmoud Rafat, just plain logic dictates when you have a position such as that, finance minister or the exchequer, have different people fill that position three times now, and you're having the fourth person come into the picture, Hunt, who has varied jobs in the past that don't exactly constitute to him being an expert on finances in a country, I'm guessing. That's just a sign of disarray. And then furthermore, you know, a certain amount of time has passed in a very crucial period of time that's, you know, you're rocked by so many different economic factors. How can, after all these people to have come and gone, for there to be a promise of stability in the economic life of Britain, so to speak?
Well, let's say it's not questions only of experts. Always the economy is a follower to politics. And policies impact the economy and the functioning of the economy in any country over the world, whatever to be the degree of democracy of this country or this nation. The question is, and matters not left completely to experts' opinions. No, the politicians and decision makers who are not experts financially intervenes in lots of matters. And also their policies they put damage lots of plans put by experts, and this is which explains also the bad politics, especially last decades, especially last one decade, and the policies were adopted by politicians in UK were completely, in lots of situations, wrong politics and wrong policies, which led today to this heritage I was talking about a few minutes ago. Madame Truss has carried when she entered Downing Street. While, again, the question is not only one reason. We have lots of reasons. United Kingdom has been accumulating lots of reasons to drop down today. It's not something happened last week or last month. It's bad policies, bad interventions in some areas of the world.
How far back would you go with that?
Well, let's just have a look what happened in the Middle East last decade and the UK intervention in last decade. UK did not intervene rationally as all as its history, comparing to its history of intervention. Its old colonial empireship should have big experience how to intervene and how to act when there are conflicts, while we found the UK intervening completely wrongly since 2003, even before that, since the Iraq war.
I just want to get an idea about the time frame that you were talking about. I'm sorry to jump in because I want to now ask that question from you, Tony Gosselin. Our guest there talked about a decade, but then he went back all the way to 2003. Tell us if you think that this is something that's either been in the making for quite some time or something that the UK maybe never really recovered from based on the 2008 financial crisis. If you want to take a look at the origins of, I guess, wrong policies or what have you.
Well, I can be absolutely precise and say, really, the origin of this is 1976. That is the removal of Harold Wilson, who was the Prime Minister, by the army in Britain and the far right and the right-wing army in Britain. They kicked him out of office and replaced him with James Callaghan. Anyone that doesn't know about this, there are some very good books on it. The Enemy Within, I think, is one of them. And The Wilson Plot is another one. Very interesting the way he was got, because he was managing the economy for the Labour Party, for the British people. And ever since then, we've had then, of course, the Thatcher era began in the 1980s. And that, I think, is actually the start of finance capitalism getting a grip on Britain. That is to say, everything is privatised bit by bit. I mean, Thatcher, it was like every 2 or 3 months, another major state-owned industry was sold off to the international markets. And that meant that anybody in the world with a lot of money could just buy up British infrastructure. This was a beginning of the end, in a way, and what they called at the time Thatcher selling off the family silver. So now finance capitalism, whatever it is, 40 years later, has become absolutely king. Finance capitalism dictates the policies to prime ministers, checkers at their private residence. Finance capitalism dictates which broadcasters are owned by who. And so the two main organs that the public have got to defend them from voracious, rich, acquisitive people, that is to say, a democratic parliament and the press, are both taken over by finance capitalists. And that's happened with the opposition Labour Party too here in the UK, where we've got a so-called opposition party which doesn't even support ordinary workers around the country, as we're getting lots of strikes starting in Britain now, even keep with their wages, keeping pace with inflation. Now, if the Labour Party can't even support that, they're clearly working, just as the Conservatives are, for the finance capitalists, for the City of London. And what we really need is a mixed economy where we have a government that asserts its strength, controls its infrastructure, and makes sure the poorest and the most or the least well-off in the country are looked after, as well as the super-rich. This government and actually the opposition Labour Party really only care about the super-rich that pay their wages for their political parties now.
I'm going to get back to that point, see if I can add something to that to challenge you. But, okay, we got about 5 minutes left, max. Mahmoud Rafat, so here we are, and here is the UK, and here is what they're dealing with. How are they going to move forward? What do they have in mind in terms of what anything that points towards some kind of recovery from what's happened? I mean, you have Jeremy Hunt that has come forward, and he has again made a U-turn. I lost count on how many U-turns have been made from the beginning of this two were cited. I think I counted five, based on what Jeremy Hunt has also said. But how can the UK move forward, based on your analysis, to come out of this situation and for there to be some stability there?
Well, I don't think there is a magic solution. It's not a bottom we will hit. We will find a solution for the economy and we will get back the economic stability. And the purchase power will get back affordable by society. I don't think that will happen in the close future. In particular, I'm repeating again, the question of the referendum of Scotland, it will be a big and huge earthquake if the Supreme Court of UK accepted the case and Scottish went to referendum, the big chance is to vote yes. And that will represent earthquake, not only for the economy, by the way, but on the whole life of the United Kingdom. But, well, simply, this nation will not exist anymore. The United Kingdom will not be the United Kingdom anymore, or the Great Britain anymore. It will be England. So there is no quick solution. There are some suggestions to be adopted on a very long term. When I say long term, it's not one decade. It's around between 2 to 5 years in order to get some stability. But that will not be, we will never be able to start on that until the decision of the Supreme Court concerning Scotland, and if yes, to see the vote results and what will happen after this result, to start from there, from 2023, when the shape of the relationship between Scotland and UK has been appeared. At that time, we will be able to start some procedures and to give the case and the files really to the experts without interventions of politicians.
Well, you have to have a stable government to do that. And you talked about the Labour Party there, and you, Tony Gosling, and you talked about how there should be a mixed, I forgot the term that you used.
Mixed economy.
But the Labour Party says that the Tories have they've lost the right to govern, and they're saying that the Conservative Party is just going to try to cling to power, and if it does that, it's going to bring down the country with it. What other options does UK have then?
Well, look, do you want Tony Blair back? I mean, because Starmer is even more extreme than Tony Blair, so he also has lost the right to govern. No, I think there are some very simple, quick solutions, but these are actually taboo. But the simple, quick solution, number one, is what I said before, is the people's quantitative easing. That is to say, printing money and giving it to the poor in order to kickstart the economy, you know, maybe even give £10,000 to everybody with no savings. A very simple thing that they could be doing. And that would be a fraction of the money that the Bank of England have been giving to the rich over the last, isn't it now 15 years, is it nearly, that they've been, well, no, not quite, but a long time anyway. So the people's QE, give that to poor people. The other thing they can do is they can regulate the privatised industries, all of the infrastructure, the railways, the electricity, the water, the gas. They can just restrict that and they can renationalise it for free. And once the government is able to set the prices properly, so that there's no racketeering going on in the infrastructure, everybody will be able to get on and make some money. So there's two very basic things. Another one, of course, is the bankers that were responsible for what we call the banksters for the financial crisis.
Sure.
The criminal bankers, they must be arrested and put in jail. I think those three measures would make a tremendous amount of difference and put the British economy back on track again.
With that, we come to an end, unfortunately, of this edition of The Spotlight. I'd like to thank Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, and also like to thank Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoub Tawi and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is your host Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and of course, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Why, dear Sheikh, do we say that the biggest miracle that the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, he brought was the Holy Quran? What kind of a miracle is it? Because seemingly it is just a book. Or is it because it speaks of the future and it has some sort of hidden knowledge that we cannot see? Because if it speaks of the future, then everybody would be a Muslim, perhaps, dear Sheikh, if we have a book that can predict the future. But seemingly it is just a book, and Muslims, we say that it is the biggest miracle of the Prophet and of Islam, naturally. But isn't it just a book at the end of the day, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Why Noble Quran is a miracle? You know that, as you mentioned, one of the miracles of Noble Prophet Muhammad is the Noble Quran. But still, I'm wondering that unfortunately some people, they do not have enough study about the verses of Noble Quran. They are not aware of the verses. And if they go to the verses, they want to quickly understand it, check it out, and, you know, they do not go to the depth of the issues of Noble Quran, because we are talking about the miracle of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, about divine word. These are not man-made.
Right.
These are not, for example, translation or a novel. These are words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So why we are sometimes ignorant of the verse of Noble Quran, and we think that if it is miracle, it has to be something, for example, talking about one interesting future news.
It must be supernatural.
It must be super
science fiction, like spaceships and stuff like that. It must be interesting, Sheikh.
Yes.
It mustn't be boring.
You know, I want to say that even in the verse of Noble Quran, still we have some news about the future. According to one narration of Imam Ali, he said that Allah inna fihi ilmu ma ya'ti wal hadith anil madi. Verse of Noble Quran has some information about the future events, about the past events. Wa dawa adaikum. It has some cure for your illnesses. I'm talking about the maybe spiritual illnesses. وَنَظْمُ بَيْنَكُمْ. And he's talking about the system of life, how to live, how to have, for example, different systems. I mean, political system, individual system, and anything related to this life. Whatever we need into this life, Noble Quran talks about those issues. And let me add one point. Actually, about why Noble Quran is a miracle, it has different dimensions. One of the dimensions is about whatever demands that you have, okay? If you put it to the verse of Noble Quran, if you deliver it to the verse of Noble Quran, you can benefit some lessons, take some lessons from the verses of Noble Quran, whatever demand and needs that you have. For example, you are an expert in one field of study. You have some expertise, you have some demands, you know, the demands are different.
Right.
If you put it and if you offer it to the verse of Noble Quran, you find and you take some lessons from that. And it is miracle from the verse of Noble Quran. We have a lot of cases, for example, a physician went to the verse of Noble Quran, studied, and he benefited the most from the verse of Noble Quran. It depends on your expertise. Some politicians, they have taken and driven some lessons from the verse. Some benef-